Travel, it's one of life's greatest pleasures. When we journey abroad, we discover new places and meet fascinating people, but we also gain perspective and take on a wider view of the world around us.
That was Trevor Ranges, and I'm Scott Coates. After more than 25 years living and working in Asia, we've developed an amazing network of interesting characters throughout the region. Talk Travel Asia is our way of sharing them with you.
Plug in and get connected to hot tips, interesting perspectives, and expert travel advice as we cultivate travel insight through intelligent conversation.
When we travel, many of us hope to experience an exotic culture or visit a spectacular natural attraction. Often these are chosen based on recommendations from family and friends or maybe long-awaited bucket list destinations. Little do many of us know, however, that the United Nations has already selected more than 1,000 such sites, hundreds of which are in Asia. These World Heritage Sites are some of the most impressive destinations on Earth, and we're going to discuss some of them on this show that you may wish to consider adding to your next Asian adventure. This is our second episode about UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Asia. Hey there, I'm Scott in Bangkok, and who am I chatting with?
This is Trevor Ranges, not too far from UNESCO World Heritage Site here in Siem Reap, Cambodia.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them around you there, right? You've got the Temples of Angkor.
Yeah, that's the nearest UNESCO site. And, you know, that maybe that's what inspired us to do this episode. Sometimes we're just like, yeah, we needed a topic. And UNESCO is always interesting because they release new sites into their list each year. And it's always an interesting, I think it's more interesting than the Oscars really to me. So, you know, when we did this, we made this huge list and we'd each gone to so many different places that we couldn't even get through it. And so we're going to do a part two. And then we quickly realized that there's probably going to have to be a part three because you and I have actually been to quite a number of these. Yeah. But there's so many more to go. So it should be a good one.
Yeah, and we're touching on the ones mostly that we've been to. There's a couple on here that we haven't been to. And then when we get on to episode 3 and 4, we'll probably touch on some of those ones we haven't been to. But according to the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, World Heritage, they say, is the designation for places on Earth that are of outstanding universal value to humanity and as such have been inscribed on this World Heritage list to protect for future generations to appreciate and enjoy. And they're broken into various categories such as cultural, natural, and mixed. As we mentioned, there's 1,000 worldwide. It seems there's 278 in the Asia Pacific, 196 of them cultural, 70 natural, 20 mixed cultural and natural that can be found across 36 nations as 5 World Heritage Sites cross boundaries between countries as well. So Trevor, what did we talk about on part one? If listeners are jazzed to go listen to part one.
Yeah, there'll be a link on the show notes. Go to talktravelasia.com. We did some really good ones. I think we had each had over 20, but the ones we chose to talk about, I did the cultural landscape of Bali province, the Subak system as a manifestation of the Trihita Karana philosophy, and how the rice harvest is part of this circle of life that's just unbelievable. I also spoke about the town of Luang Prabang, which it was very close to my heart. I haven't been there. I guess I still hold it in my heart. And I hope that having a UNESCO World Heritage Site continues to protect Luang Prabang. The central sector of the imperial city of Thang Long in Hanoi. Hanoi in Vietnam is this, I guess it's called the Citadel, but it went over hundreds of years. I mean, the city's 1,000 years old, I guess. I'd never been there before, so on my last trip, I checked it out. It is really neat. And then Bagan in Myanmar, which I visited, 20 years ago now. That's interesting that I haven't visited some of these places in a while. Bagan is pretty spectacular. Definitely worthy of the status and the protection that it affords. How about you, Scott? What did you talk about?
Yeah, that's a good list. I talked about the Borobudur Buddhist temple compounds in Indonesia, and that is an awesome spot that I went to probably 8-9 years ago, and it's actually featured as one of the photos that we use in Talk Travel Asia. That's a must-see, I think, for people that like monuments. And then I also talked about the Hiroshima Peace Memorial, which I've been to with Greg from the Bangkok podcast, probably 15 years ago, really moving place. The Kathmandu Valley was my third one, which I've also been lucky enough to spend a lot of time in. And the fourth one, I've also been to the old town of Gaul in Sri Lanka and its fortifications on the south coast there. So those were four cool ones. And before we get into the ones we've picked for this episode, Trevor, can you tell people if they like the show, how can they support us to help keep it going?
Gosh, well, I guess everybody's heard of Patreon by now. So you can go to Patreon and search for Talk Travel Asia, or you can go to our show notes, talktravelasia.com. Again, where we have great links, Google Maps to help you explore. And there'll be a button there on the homepage to donate. Even just a dollar an episode, that's $2 a month. It adds up to help us cover the costs of having fun, I guess. I don't know. We enjoy doing this, but we also enjoy doing special episodes for our guests. We recently shared a video of Scott cycling up Khao Yai, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Thailand, which I haven't been to in a while either, but is amazing and beautiful. So that must be pretty cool to see. So thank you for patrons enjoying that by supporting the show. You want to get into it?
Yeah, sure. What's your first one you're going to share?
Oh, yeah. I picked one here in Cambodia. According to UNESCO, the temple zone of Sambor Prekuk, archaeological site of ancient Isanapura, is the temple of the richness of the forest in the Khmer language. And this was the capital of the Chenla Empire that flourished in the late 6th and early 7th centuries AD, prior to the founding of Angkor. Something I wrote, there are more than 100 temples scattered across a quiet, peaceful forest. Brick temples honoring various Hindu gods and goddesses feature unique design and carving representing the pre-Angkorian Sambor Prekuk style. The temples are less grandiose than those at Angkor, closer perhaps to Sukhothai, but in a different style. Octagonal towers with flying palaces of carved brick and sandstone, small Indian-esque busts, where a bronze caged bull, I believe, was discovered. Sambor Prekuk is something that you can appreciate in like the finer details. It's got some artistic beauty, and the forest there is really cool. And before Scott maybe shares our visit there together, I think it's really worth a stop at the Kampong Thom Museum. So if you're traveling between Siem Reap and Phnom Penh by land, in either direction, Kampong Thom is the town halfway between the two. There's a small museum there that you can just park at and like walk inside, walk around. You could walk it in a minute, but it's worth, you know, 10 minutes. You could look at each piece for a minute and spend a half an hour there. It's got some beautiful artwork from the temples that they kept from being looted, and it's spectacular. So if you're driving through Kampong Thom, that's absolutely worth a stop at the provincial museum, just because the temples themselves are a good hour return, you know, maybe 2 hours if you wanted to enjoy it as like a detour from Kampong Thom. But Scott and I did it once, and it was totally worth it.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have even known about it unless you mentioned it. And if you're driving between Phnom Penh and Siem Reap, it makes for a really good stop. And I remember it was super hot, but we got on little village bikes and rode around, and there was barely anyone there, which made it neat. And I remember for some reason I did need a scarf, and then it seemed like 20 kids all emerged from the trees, all with scarves, and I got mobbed by kids selling scarves. But yeah, it was an impressive lesser known site. Again, if you're traveling by land between those two spots, definitely stop in and experience Sambor Prekuk. That's a good one, Trevor. Mm.
Yeah, you know, it's. I wonder if becoming a UNESCO World Heritage Site makes it more popular, which again is a good thing for the local economy there. There was always a good like a homestay community there if you wanted to do lunch there and whatnot. The first time I went, it was like an incipient homestay experience, but they caught one of their chickens and they made some fried rice for lunch with it, and it's quite an experience. It's beautiful though. It's very different from Angkor, but charming and peaceful.
Yeah. Good one. Well, my first one, I haven't been here. And one of the things I've enjoyed about reading the UNESCO World Heritage Site pages, and we'll link to it from the show notes, is that you learn about these places, right? So Kinabalu Park, this is on outside of Kota Kinabalu City in the state of Sabah in Malaysia. And I've been to Kota Kinabalu City, but I was doing some work and I didn't get a chance to get out to the countryside. Bit of a bummer. But this is on the northern end of the island of Borneo. This World Heritage property covers 75,000 hectares, and it's key feature is, of course, Mount Kinabalu, which raises to 4,095 meters. And it says it's the highest mountain between the Himalayas and New Guinea. But what I don't really understand is I think Pu Tau in the north of Myanmar in the Himalayas there is higher. So maybe that's what they mean is beyond that. It's, I think, the highest in Southeast Asia. But it's the mountain itself is a granite intrusion. They say that was formed about 15 million years ago. And was thrust upwards about a million years ago when some tectonic plates moved. But what makes it, I guess, really special in a World Heritage Site is it varies from 152 meters to that 4,095. So it has a wide array of habitats from rich tropical lowland and rainforest, which is about 35% of that park, to what they call tropical montane forest, which is about 37% of it. And then subalpine forest and scrub at the higher elevations and rock cover apparently 16% of it. But they say that it contains representatives of at least half of all Borneo's plant species and is exceptionally rich in species with elements from the Himalayas, China, Australia, Malaysia, and pan-tropical forests. So it also says it has half of all Borneo's birds, mammals, and amphibian species and two-thirds of all Bornean reptiles. So, I mean, plant life, animal life, it's got it covered. It's got a ton of it and it's got all those different zones. So I've heard that, you know, you can do the hike and it's not super hard. And there's also some, I always forget what they call it, but it's an Italian word where you can do a, or like a ropes course on part of it. I've heard kind of mixed reviews of the hike itself, but it sounds like spending some time in that larger park is probably worthwhile.
Yeah, I can attest to that because I've done two of those three things. I haven't been to the top there. It's majestic. We should put a photo of this on the show notes just so people could see what the top of Mount Kinabalu looks like because it's this big pointy kind of peak. Nat and I, way back in the day, we stayed at the base camp. And like at the base camp area, there's really nice lodges and there's all these, it kind of reminded me of the Anantara Chiang Rai, you know, how that's kind of laid out. But then connecting it are all these like day trip hiking trails, like through the forest. And like, I have some spectacular photos of these beautiful plants and flowers and yeah, the birds, it was really amazing. And then, so just going to the base camp is worth it. You don't even need to go up to the top. And then there's nice digs, little restaurants and stuff. Like Malaysia's developed in this way for national park, you know, amenities and stuff for sure. Then we ended up on the other side of the island and we flew back to Kota Kinabalu and we were in like a small, like, I don't know, like a Cessna kind of thing, right? And we couldn't fly over the mountain because it's so tall. We flew underneath like the cloud layer and we sort of followed We followed the road like in between these valleys, like of these peaks on either side. It was spectacular and like scary and beautiful. So we couldn't see the top, but like just flying through the passes was unbelievable.
That's cool. I'm glad you made it there. I didn't know you had made it there. And it's somewhere now that I'm high on my list or higher. And boy, I wish I'd made time to get there when I was doing some work in the city. So where are you taking us next, Trevor?
They're not quite contemporary, but Semberprekuk and Sukhothai kind of give me the same kind of vibe. So yeah. So I'm talking about the kingdoms of Sukhothai or the kingdom of Sukhothai. This is something that I wrote that I found on my computer. Thais began to emerge as a dominant force in the region in the 13th century, gradually asserting independence from neighboring kingdoms. Founded in 1238, the Kingdom of Sukhothai was named, quote, the dawn of happiness by its rulers. The Sukhothai period is considered a golden era of Thai history, an ideal state in a land of plenty, governed by paternal and benevolent kings, the most famous of whom was Ramkhamhaeng the Great, 1279 to 1298, who greatly expanded the kingdom's borders. In addition to developing some of the most beautiful Thai art, the Sukhothai kingdom is credited with developing the modern alphabet. I had a little bit more history that you guys can read on the website. The Sukhothai was allies with Lan Na and Chiang Mai to fight against like Mongol invaders from the north, and obviously had some conflict with Jayavarman and that era of Angkor. So Sukhothai was a very important political place, but like spiritually, I think is what it gets this status for. Like you go there and like these Buddhist temples are spectacularly beautiful, and the Buddha images in them are like elegant and, I don't know, awe-inspiring and in a very peaceful kind of way. And you just ride little bicycles around because it's all flat. And I remember it not being that busy. Maybe it's busier nowadays, Scott, if you've been there more recently. But yeah, Sukhothai art is gorgeous, and it's a beautiful place to visit.
Yeah, I was last there in 2000, in that first year of COVID. So there weren't international travelers, and it wasn't very busy. I don't know about now. I think one of the things that makes it not soupy corner is, you know, it's probably 3 hours south of Chiang Mai. And so then you're looking at like 7 hours north of Bangkok. So there is a little airport there, but I think unless people really make a deliberate effort to get there, it's not kind of on the natural stopping route, but it is quite a special place, conducive to bikes, as you mentioned, but also there are so many monuments that you could easily use a car to. But Sukhothai is well worth it if you enjoy history. And I like kind of how you touch upon the time periods about what was going on in Angkor at that time. And imagining what's going on in Sukhothai Empire. So that is a great one.
Yeah, and they have amazing noodles, like Sukhothai noodles. That's one of my go-tos in Bangkok even. But and cheap, I remember, like the train runs through there. So you can take the train to Sukhothai, and the airport is Bangkok Airways. And that ticket's a little expensive, but if you could time it to like fly in, see the park, and then catch the train as it's passing on the way to Chiang Mai, like that could be like a pretty cool way to do it. Yeah, because the noodles were good. They're really into ceramics. Like some of their ancient kingdoms around there made these amazing ceramics. And at the airport, they let us throw our own pots and stuff. They had like hands-on cultural exhibits. They really do take pride in their history, and they showcase it very nicely as well. So yeah, maybe it's nice that people don't visit it so often. But
definitely worth a night too. I think I spent one or two nights, so no need to rush. Go on, Trevor. Good pick. We're going to Singapore for my next one. And I've been this place, I think, twice, and I've jogged through it, but I didn't realize that it was, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And then I was really curious as to the why, right? So it's the Singapore Botanic Gardens, and it's situated right in the heart of the city of Singapore, which I guess everything is really, to be honest with it, but this is how they read it. But it says it demonstrates the evolution of a British tropical colonial botanical garden from a pleasure garden in the English landscape style to a colonial economic garden with facilities for horticulture and botanical research, and on to a modern and world-class botanic garden, scientific institution, and place of conservation, recreation, and education. It was established way back in 1859, and so it's very well preserved. It's been continually used since 1859, I guess, what also makes it quite unique compared to some of the other global gardens, which I guess were left during wars and whatnot. So they say it's just an outstanding example of British tropical botanical garden. And it also helped advance knowledge around scientific knowledge of particular fields in botany, horticulture, and including the development of plantation rubber. So I guess they did study way back when on how to develop proper rubber plantations. So it's really been the center of plant research in Southeast Asia since the 19th century, and quite a neat place. Beautiful, whether it's just a walk or I've been jogging there a couple times, but it is big. It's well worth a visit. And I really had no idea it had been around so long or played such a role in research and the modern rubber plantation.
Wow. I probably read some of that on a sign or two. I've been to Singapore on a number of occasions, and on one of those, it was like maybe a Sunday or felt like a Sunday, and we're like, what do you want to do? So we went to check out the botanical gardens, and we spent at least a half a day there. Like it's so massive, and it's beautiful, and there's places to, I mean, Singapore is so well organized, so there's signs telling you all the history and all this stuff. But yeah, it was a really nice day, just like strolling around and enjoying the weather. You'd want to go when it's a little bit cool, I guess, but you know, there's trees and stuff in there, right? So you'll find a cool spot to relax.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know you're going to one of the world's most famous sites for your next one.
Yeah, this was funny. So it's funny because I'm like, what am I going to say? Like, everybody's heard of the Great Wall of China. And like, it's like one of the wonders of the world, I guess, isn't it? It's got to be. So of course it would be UNESCO World Heritage Site. Probably one of the first, don't you think?
Probably.
So I went to the Great Wall once. I had that honor and it was great. Amazing, amazing wall, I think. But I too had to do some history because I didn't, you know, Chinese history is so fascinating because it's so long. But I wanted to learn something different. So I looked up the word. I'm like, what is the word for Great Wall in China? And the word means like city. It's the wall. It always referred to a wall around a city. Okay, so I've been to a part of the Great Wall and it was amazing. So we'll go with amazing wall. But what was the actual word that the Chinese used for the Great Wall? I wanted to know the name of this thing, like the dawn of happiness for Sukhothai, you know? And the word is of the wall around a city, in which by extension became the word for portions of the wall and then the entire wall, which is generally referred to as the 10,000 li or 10,000 mile wall. So it's the modern day word for city in Chinese, as a matter of fact. So yeah, so I'm not going to try and pronounce it, but the wall means city. Because like if you built such a wall, then the population that lived behind it seemed to be bestowed like some sort of title or land or something like that as a city. And then over the centuries, it was built up. And we'll talk about that in a second. But one of the various regional nicknames for the wall that I liked was the Earth Dragon. Which sounds cool because it snakes over the mountains and across the country. According to Wikipedia, the Great Wall of China is a series of fortifications that were built across northern borders of ancient Chinese states as a protection against nomadic groups from the Eurasian steppe. Summarizing now, between the 7th century BC, selective stretches were later joined by the first emperor of China in 220 to 206 BC. But almost none of that wall remains, okay, which is crazy. So what happened there? Where did all those stones go? Did those stones end up going back to the wall? I don't know. But later on, successive dynasties built and maintained different stretches of their own border walls, again, going back to the more traditional thing. And the best known of those were built by the Ming Dynasty between 1368 and 1644.
Yeah.
So you got to imagine a lot of building went on then. So I think there's a lot of history here. When I went, we were given access to a kind of remote area of the wall where we were able to walk all day without any other people in sight. And it was spectacular. Mountainous terrain, remote tower posts. It was like winter, but you're like sweating because you're in the sun and elevation and you're climbing up these steep stone steps. Like the wall is fascinating, and the outposts are kind of the cool places where you can find shade and like eat some apples and take in the view, because it's just like spectacular like countryside. Then we ended up like rappelling off one of the towers and had a kind of a little party by a campfire and crushed a whole bunch of Chinese beers and whatever hooch they were serving up. It was pretty amazing. One interesting fact I found, people used to always say that it was like the only thing you could see from space. But you could see the East Barai here at Angkor from space as well. But apparently it's the only thing you can see from the moon is what I've read. It's the only human structure that's visible from the moon.
Can't be too many people that can confirm that one, but that's a good pick. And I was lucky enough a year after you to spend time on the Great Wall. And I think it was through a leadership program in Hawaii. And I had a similar experience where we were walking with no other tourists or visitors. And then I even split off from our group and sort of was all alone for about 45 minutes. That was really good. And I got to say, I was scared to go because I thought it's not going to live up to everything you've read about it. And we were lucky enough to end up in a quiet area where, it kind of blew my mind.
Yeah, because once you actually did get to the public area, there was lots of people walking on the wall. But so those are like kind of day trip destinations, I guess, from Beijing. But I mean, if you had the chance to go visit some sections of it, it lives up to the hype, at least
for
what
sure.
I saw. It
was good spectacular. One. So we're covering some major ones. And my third one is also one of the very famous premier Thai kingdom. So you're getting your dose of Thai history here. And this is the historic city of Ayutthaya. And I've probably been there, geez, I don't know, 30 times because I used to lead trips there. And it's not quite on the scale of Angkor or Bagan, but I think if you're in Bangkok, it's super worth a visit. It's about 90 kilometers north of the city. So, you know, if you just go early before rush hour or a bit after, you can be there in, say, 90 minutes. And it's kind of regarded as the grandest period in Thai history. So it was founded after Sukhothai, or Sukhothai was still going on, but kind of overlapped. But it was started in 1350, and it was the second great capital of the Siamese kingdom. And it fell in 1767 when it was sacked by the Burmese. And during that period, it grew to be what was one of the world's largest and most cosmopolitan urban areas on the Worth, right? Which is kind of tough to wrap your head around, right? I guess it was grander and bigger than Paris or London at the time. It became a really big center for global diplomacy and commerce. And one thing that's interesting about Ayutthaya is it is 90 kilometers north of Bangkok, but it is connected to the Gulf of Thailand by the Chao Phraya River. And the Chao Phraya River is a tidal river. And so big boats, European boats, would actually come up the river, right, and visit Ayutthaya. And Ayutthaya itself was on an island. So they had natural protection, which I believe they dug out a bit more. But it became a big trading area, and the Portuguese were the first to come here in 1511, right? That's a long time ago. So I mentioned that the Burmese sacked Ayutthaya in 1767. They knocked the heads off the stone Buddhas. They melted the gold off the chedis and the statues. And it's sort of rumored that a lot of the gold on Shwedagon Pagoda in Yangon comes from Ayutthaya. But over 417 years, this was the Grand Kingdom, and they occupied parts of northern Malaysia at that point, parts of western Cambodia, and parts of eastern Myanmar. So it also grew to its largest physical size at that time and kind of filled a vacuum left by the fall of Angkor. So yeah, I think it's a fascinating place, really, really, really worth a visit if you're in Bangkok.
Yeah, it's pretty quick from Bangkok, and I'd like to do that by train as well. And again, yeah, it was one of the world's most cosmopolitan cities, as was Lopburi, right, I believe, in its own time. But let's say the fall of Angkor, but Ayutthaya was kind of in the right place at the right time, I think, in history to like kind of adopt Angkor's place as the preeminent kind of political hub at a time when the world was, global trade was happening so much more quickly, and that location on the river really helped Ayutthaya flourish. And I had to heard the Shwedagon story about the gold too, but I mean, they made off with it, I guess. But you know, what goes around comes around sometimes in this world of geopolitics in the ancient Asia, I guess. You know, it was cool though. I mean, you can learn all this history, but it's really about going there to experience it. And I think writing can be better than teaching for learning sometimes. Because when I'd always was like, oh yeah, Ayutthaya, it's a cool place to go as a day trip. But when I wrote like guidebook material about it, and I visited like every temple, and there's like 60 of them or something like that. Like if you take some time to explore the area and some of the lesser frequented places, there's some like spectacular things there. So I think it's really charming. It's like, it's worth the status for sure from the history. But if you go, just don't try to do the bucket list things. Try to avoid the crowds a little bit, and you can enjoy the
experience. Yeah, makes a perfect more day trip, but also, you know, like a lot of places we say, stay a night too. There's better and better hotels there. There's some cute guest houses. I think it's well worth a stay overnight. So we're each going to do one more. Trevor, what's your fourth and final one from your side?
Yeah, here's one that I'm not sure if I've been to the particular areas mentioned, because some of these can be quite expansive. I'm going to discuss the Tropical Rainforest Heritage of Sumatra. I got tripped up there because like it's actually on the heritage. So I've been to Sumatra. I think I talked about it on Tantalizing Travel Tales 1. I definitely recently talked about it on Trevor's first trip to Asia, when I went to Sumatra and Bukit Luang and did like an overnight trek up in the jungle. It's spectacular. Again, like if like even that was already starting to be visited, but still mostly wild, that heritage is gorgeous. And I hope that they're preserving it well. You know, 3 decades ago when I got there, it was still, there were still like wild orangutans. There was ones they were releasing from the sanctuary there. But I climbed, there's wild gibbons I saw. Again, like Borneo, just spectacular beauty. Now, there's 1,000 tigers still in Sumatra. Like, I looked at the, I don't remember how big this region is that they're saying is still like preserved or unspoiled, but 1,000 tigers is quite a lot, actually, because just if you think about land-wise, because tigers' terrain is quite large. You can't have like 1,000 tigers in a small area, right? So hopefully the tigers still have this beautiful area to explore for a long time because UNESCO has chosen it as a protected area.
I like that it's a forest, like a natural environment, right? And this kind of reminds me of Khao Yai, about 2.5 hours north east of Bangkok, and its forest is one of the oldest and also UNESCO site, I think. So, yeah, I mean, you've gotten me super switched on Sumatra, as well as a book that we read last year. Yeah. And yeah, I'm envious on this one. I've got to get to Sumatra. So yeah, good one, Trevor. So for my last one, it's, again, I didn't realize that these places together were World Heritage Site, and it's Malacca and Georgetown, these historic cities along the Straits of Malacca in Malaysia. And Malacca is sort of midway down Malaysia on the west coast, but then Georgetown is up in the north, kind of west corner of the city. So I didn't realize that they've put them together. So it seems that the Portuguese actually were down here in Malacca and Georgetown in 1508. And UNESCO says they are remarkable examples of historical colonial towns on the Straits of Malacca that still demonstrate a succession of historical and cultural influences from the various people that mix there from east and west, right? And that within the centers of both those places and the city centers, you still have what they call multicultural living heritage or buildings. So you can still see some of these shop houses in action and the unique layout and design of them with influence from Great Britain and Portugal, even from people from the Middle East and the Indian subcontinent and all the way from China. So you had a real mixing of people in these areas that kind of traded up that whole coast of Malacca and actually all the way to Phuket. If you go to old Phuket town, and even off of Koh Lanta in Thailand, I saw an old trader's mansion on a little island there that comes from this trade route. So they say it bears testimony to a living multicultural heritage and tradition of Asia with a mixing of religions and cultures that don't really coexist anywhere else except along that Malay archipelago. So yeah, I think they're neat places. The shop houses are kind of what people go for these days, but I'm quite fascinated by the larger trade along there. So it's neat that those two places together in Malaysia are UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Wow, 8 for 8, Scott. I've been to all 8 of our UNESCO World Heritage Sites we discussed today. Yeah, I've been to Georgetown a few times now, I guess. I first went in 96 because I saw the opening ceremonies of the Atlanta Olympics there. But I've always liked Georgetown, and it's a very charming place. I've been to like the old fort. I went to like the old bank, some of these colonial era kind of remnants. But there is that side of the culture. And then Malaysia is very multicultural to start with, you know. And there's lots of great food and they have art and, you know, I haven't been all over. I hitchhiked out to the West Coast or took a bus, sorry, out to the West Coast of
Penang.
What's the island there? Penang. Yeah. I don't know. Malacca's in the South, I believe, but you're right, with Phuket town, it kind of has that same vibe. It's cool.
Yeah, it is worthwhile. I forgot the food too. So wow, 8 for 8. That's pretty cool that you've been to all 8 of those, Trevor. I'm envious. Look, before we stop, I want you to let our listeners know about something special that you worked on for years. Can you tell us about your novel?
Oh yeah. Thanks, Scott. It was something I did during COVID. Just because I'd never tried writing a novel before and it seemed like something to do. I said it in the near future. So I began on April 1st, 2020. And so I decided to have my novel be set beginning on April 22nd, 2024. So on Earth Day of this year, I've launched my novel as a serial on Kindle Vella, so that it comes out in episodes as the events unfold. And then the first part of the story will be released in novellas on Amazon. So we'll have links to the show notes. The first book I went with calling the Einstein event, which was one of the early working titles of the story. The series is the love story. It's Arana, which is a combination of Anna and Aaron Jones names. They're the millennial mom and dad super couple who changed the world. So it's kind of a supernatural mystery, rom-com, American fable, I guess. So there'll be a link to the Einstein event and Arana's story on the show notes or on my Facebook page. But check it out. Yeah, I think it's kind of fun. Scott helped me. He read some early drafts, gave me some good feedback, and I think it's fun.
Yeah, and I'm not saying this just because I'm your friend, but I honestly mean it. I read three different versions of it, and I enjoyed it every single time. And it's just a fun book, and I like the way you're now releasing it in like novellas, like quarters. So I really encourage people to give it a read. It's a lot of fun. You'll definitely want the next part when you read one part. So yeah, kudos to you, Trevor, on kind of seeing that through. It's super difficult, I can imagine, to write a novella, and a lot of fun. If you've had fun listening to this, become a patron. And patrons are people who sponsor the show from a couple dollars a month upwards. You can click donate on our website or go to patreon.com and search Talk Travel Asia. And not only do you get a warm, fuzzy feeling of support, but you also get a special bonus episode in between each of these episodes. And we share videos sometimes. Sometimes it's Trevor and I chatting about something, but it's a fun little extra. So thanks for listening. Trevor, can you take us out?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. That was a good show. And I know that we have a little list of more to talk about on episode 3. So stay tuned, listeners. We have a new episode that's out every 2 weeks, sometimes with a guest, sometimes just dropping knowledge. And we appreciate you for listening. So thanks a lot.
Thanks for joining us on Talk Travel Asia. We look forward to sharing with you again soon.
Hey Scott, do you remember the time we walked on top of the wall at Angkor Thom in Cambodia?